Security by Poole Anderson. Part 3. His room was small and austere, but privacy was nice. The lab crew ate in the common refectory. Beyond the edge of their territory, great bulkheads blocked off 3/4 of the space station. Lancaster was sure that many people and several Martians lived there, for in the days that followed, he saw any number of strangers appearing and disappearing in the region allowed him. Most of these were workmen of some kind or other, called in to help the lab crew as needed. But all of them were tight-lipped. They must have been cautioned not to speak to the guest more than was strictly necessary. Living was Spartan in the station. It rotated fast enough to give weight, but even on the outer skin, that was only 1/2 Earth gravity. A couple of silent Martians prepared undistinguished meals and did housework in the quarters. There were no films or other organized recreation, though Lancaster was told that the forbidden sector included a good-sized room for athletics. But the crew he worked with didn't seem to mind. They had their own large collections of books and music wires, which they borrowed from each other. They played chess and poker with savage skill. Conversation was at first somewhat restrained in Lancaster's presence, and most of the humor had so little reference to things he knew that he couldn't follow it. But he became aware that they talked with more animation and intelligence than his friends on Earth. Manners were utterly informal, and it wasn't long before even Lancaster was being addressed by his first name. But cooperation was smooth, and there seemed to be none of the intrigue and backbiting of a typical project crew. And the work filled their lives. Lancaster was caught up in it the day after his arrival, realized at once what it meant, and was plunged into the fascination of it. Berg hadn't lied. This was big. The perfect dielectric. Such, at least, was the aim of the project. It was explained to Lancaster that one Dr. Sophoulis had first seen the possibilities and organized the research. It had gone ahead slowly, hampered by a lack of needed materials and expert personnel. When Sophoulis died, none of his assistants felt capable of carrying on the work at any decent rate of speed. They were all competent in their various specialties, but it takes more than training to do basic research. A certain inborn intuitive flair is needed. So they had sent to Earth for a new boss, Lancaster. The physicist scratched his head in puzzlement. It didn't seem right that something so important should have to take the leavings of technical personnel. Secrecy or not, the most competent men on Earth should have been tapped for this job, and they should have been given everything they needed to carry it through. Then he forgot his bewilderment in the clean, chill ecstasy of his work. Man had been hunting superior dielectrics for a long time now. It was more than a question of finding the perfect electrical insulator, though that would be handy, too. What was really important was the sort of condensers made possible by a genuinely good dielectric material. Given that, you could do fantastic things in electronics. Most significant of all was the matter of energy storage. If you could store large amounts of electricity in an accumulator of small volume, without appreciable leakage loss, you could build generators designed to handle average rather than peak load, with resultant savings in cost. You could build electric motors containing their own energy supply and hence portable, which meant electric automobiles and possibly aircraft. You could use inconveniently located power sources, such as remote waterfalls or dilute sources like sunlight, to augment, maybe eventually replace, the waning reserves of fuel and fissionable materials. You could... Lancaster's mind gave up on all the possibilities opening before him, and settled down to the immediate task at hand. The original mineral was found on Venus, in the Gorbu-Vashtar country, explained Karen Marek. Here's a sample. She gave him a lump of rough, dense material, which glittered in hard rainbow points of light. It was just a curiosity at first, till somebody thought to test its electrical properties. Those were slightly fantastic. We have all chemical and physical data on this stuff already, of course, as well as an excellent idea of its crystal structure. It's a funny mixture of barium and titanium compounds with some rare earths and... well, read the report for yourself. Lancaster's eyes skimmed down the sheaf of papers she handed him. "Can't make very good condensers out of this," he objected. "Too brittle. And look how the properties vary with temperature. A practical dielectric has to be stable in every way, at least over the range of conditions you intend to use it in." She nodded. "Of course. Anyway, the mineral is very rare on Venus, and you know how tough it is to search for anything in Gorbu-Vashtar. What's important is the lead it gave to Sophoulis. You see, the dielectric constant of this material isn't constant at all. It increases with applied voltage. Look at this curve here." Lancaster whistled. "Phew! What the devil? But that's impossible! That much variability means a crystal structure which is, flexible, damn it! But you've got a brittle substance here!" According to the accepted theory of dielectricity, this could not be. Lancaster realized with a lump thumping behind his veins that the theory would have to be modified. Rather, this was an altogether different phenomenon from normal insulation. He supposed some geological freak had formed the mineral. Venus was a strange planet anyway. But that didn't matter. The important thing now was to get to know this process. He went off into a happy mist of quantum mechanics, oscillation theory, and periodic functions of a complex variable. Karen and Isaacson exchanged a slow smile. Sophoulis and his people had done heroic work under adverse conditions. A tentative theory of the mechanism involved had already been formulated, and the search had started for a means to duplicate the superdielectricity in materials otherwise more suitable to man's needs. But as he grew familiar with the place and the job, Lancaster wondered just how adverse the conditions really were. True, the equipment was old and cranky, much of it haywired together, much of it invented from scratch. But Rakan the Martian, for all his lack of formal education, was unbelievably clever where it came to making apparatus and making it behave. And Friedrichs was a top-flight designer. The lab had what it needed. Wasn't that enough? The rest of Lancaster's crew were equally good. The Dufresnes were physical chemists par excellence. Isaacson, a brilliant crystallographer with an unusual brain for mathematics. Huang, an expert on quantum theory and interatomic forces. Karen, an imaginative experimenter. None of them quite had the synthesizing mentality needed for an overall picture and forevision of the general direction of work. That had been Sophoulis's share, and was now Lancaster's. But they were all cheerful and skilled where it came to detail work, and could often make suggestions in a theoretical line. Then, too, there was no security snooping about, no petty scramble for recognition and promotion, no red tape. What was more important, Lancaster began to realize, was the personal nature of the whole affair. In a project, the overall chief set the pattern, and it was followed by his subordinates with increasingly less latitude as you worked down through the lower ranks. You did what you were told, produced results or else, and kept your mouth shut outside your own sector of the project. You had only the vaguest idea of what actually was being created, and why, and how it fitted into the broad scheme of society. Huang and Rakan commented on that one evening at dinner, when they had grown more relaxed in Lancaster's presence. "It was inevitable, I suppose, that scientific research should become corporate," said the Chinese. So much equipment was needed, and so many specialties had to be coordinated, that the solitary genius, with only a few assistants, hadn't a chance. Nevertheless, it's a pity. It's destroyed initiative in many promising young men. The top man is no longer a scientist at all. He's an administrator with some technical background. The lower ranks do have to exercise ingenuity, yes, but only along the lines they are ordered to follow. If some interesting sideline crops up, they can't investigate it. All they can do is submit a memorandum to the chief, and most likely, if anything is done, it will be carried out by someone else.
What would you do about it? Shrugged Lancaster. You just admitted that the old-time genius in a garret can't compete.
No, but the small team of creative specialists, each with an excellent understanding of the other's fields, and each working in a loose, free-willed cooperation with the rest, can. Indeed, the results will be much better. It was tried once, you know. The early cybernetics men back in the last century worked that way.
I wish we could co-opt some biologists and psychologists into this, murmured Rakan.
His English was good, though indescribably accented by his vocal apparatus.
The cellular and neural implications of dielectricity look promising. Maybe later.
Well, said Lancaster defensively, a large project can be made more secure. Less chance of leakage. Huang said nothing, but he cocked an eyebrow at an almost treasonable angle. In going through Sefulis's equations, Lancaster found what he believed was the flaw that was blocking progress. The man had used a simplified quantum mechanics without correction for relativistic effects. That made for neater mathematics, but overlooked certain space-time aspects of the psi function. The error was excusable, for Sefulis had not been familiar with the Bologna matrix, a mathematical tool that brought order into what was otherwise incomprehensible chaos. Bologna's work was still classified information, being too useful in the design of new alloys for general consumption. Lancaster went happily to work correcting the equations. But when he was finished, he realized that he had no business showing his results without proper clearance. He wandered glumly into the lab. Karen was there alone, setting up an apparatus for the next attempt at heat treatment. A smock covered her into shapelessness, and her spectacular hair was bound up in a kerchief, but she still looked good. Lancaster, a shy man, was more susceptible to her than he wanted to be.
"Where's Berg?" he asked.
"Back on Earth with Jessup," she told him.
"Why?"
"Damn, it holds up the whole business till he returns," Lancaster explained his difficulty. Karen laughed.
"Oh, that's all right," she said in the low voice he liked to hear.
"We've all been cleared."
"Not officially. I've got to see the papers."
She glared at him then and stamped her foot.
"How stupid can you get without having to be spoon-fed?" she snapped. "You've seen how much we think of regulations here. Let's have those equations, Mac."
"But, blast it, Karen, you don't appreciate the need for security. Berg explained it to me once, how dangerous the rebels are and how easily they can steal our secrets. And they'll stop at nothing. Do you want another hemispheric war?" She looked oddly at him, and when she spoke, it was softly. "Alan, do you really believe that?"
"Certainly! It's obvious, isn't it? Our country is maintaining the peace of the solar system. Once we drop the reins, all hell will run away from us."
"What's wrong with setting up a worldwide federation of countries? Most other nations are willing."
"But that... it's not practical."
"How do you know? It's never been tried."
"Anyway, we can't decide policy. That's just not for us.
The United States is a democratic country, remember?
But... Lancaster looked away. For a moment he stood unspeaking, and she watched him with grave eyes and said nothing. Then, not really knowing why he did it, he lifted a defiant head.
All right, we'll go ahead, and if Berg sends us all to camp, don't blame me.
He won't. She laughed and clapped his shoulder. You know, Alan, there are times when I think you're human after all.
Thanks, he grinned wryly. How about having a beer with me now, to celebrate?
Why, sure. They went down to the shop. A cooler of beer was there, its contents being reckoned as among the essential supplies brought from Earth by Jessup. Lancaster uncapped two bottles, and he and Karen sat down on a bench, swinging their legs and looking over the silent waiting machines. Most of the station personnel were off duty now, in the arbitrary night. He sighed at last.
I like it here.
I'm glad you do, Alan. It's a funny place, but I like it. The station and all its wacky inhabitants. They're heterodox as the very devil, and would have trouble getting a dog catcher's job back home, but they're all refreshing.
Lancaster snapped his fingers. Say, that's it. That's why you're all out here. The government needs your talents, and you aren't quite trusted, so you're put here out of range of spies, right?
Do you have to see a rebel with notebook in hand under every bed? She asked with a hint of weariness.
The First Amendment hasn't been repealed yet, they say. Theoretically, we're all entitled to our own opinions.
Okay, okay, I won't argue politics. Tell me about some of the people here, will you? They're an odd bunch.
I can't tell you much, Alan. That's where security does apply. Isaacson is a Martian colonist. You've probably guessed that already. Jessup lost his hand in a fight with some enemies once. The Dufresnes had a son who was killed in the Moroccan incident. Lancaster remembered that that affair had involved American power used to crush a French spy ring centered in North Africa. Sovereignty had been brushed aside. But damn it, you had to preserve the status quo for your own survival, if nothing else. Huang had to go into exile when the Chinese government changed hands a few years back.
Yes? He asked when her voice faded out.
Oh, I might as well tell you. My husband and I lived in America after our marriage. He was a good biotechnician and had a job with one of the big pharmaceutical companies. Only he went to camp. Later he died or was shot. I don't know which.
Her words were flat.
That's a shame, he said inadequately. The funny part of it is, he wasn't engaged in treason at all. He was quite satisfied with things as they were. Oh, he talked a little, but so does everybody. I imagine some rival or enemy put the finger on him.
Those things happen, said Lancaster. It's too bad, but they happen.
They're bound to occur in a police state, she snapped.
Sorry, we weren't going to argue politics, were we? I never said the world was perfect, Karen. Far from it. Only, what alternative have we got? Any change is likely to be so dangerous that... Well, man can't afford mistakes.
No, he can't. But I wonder if he isn't making one right now. Oh, well, give me another beer.
They talked on indifferent subjects till Karen said it was her bedtime.
Lancaster escorted her to her apartment. She looked at him curiously as he said good night, then went inside and closed the door. Lancaster had trouble getting to sleep. End of part 3.